The Rufus Project would like to advise the following podcast contains spoilers for 1997's Batman and Robin. If you do not wish to have this movie spoiled, please watch the movie before listening to the following podcast. After redeeming one franchise-killing sequel, can we do it again? Is Batman and Robin a forgotten masterpiece, or are the bat nipples only the beginning of its problems? Let's find out after the theme.
Boy? Oh boy.
Is it too good to be bad? So bad it's good. What's this movie? Do you think we should? It's got bad I love dodgy creatures, but we want to know what the redeeming features.
Boy?
Hello and welcome to the Rufus Project Redeeming Features cast. This time looking at the 1997 movie Batman and Robin. I'm your host Trevor Holland and I am joined by my good friend and co-host
Christian Fletcher. Thanks for having me on board again, Trevor, and thanks for letting me recommend the film for this fortnight.
It's always fun. It's always the anticipation just before the reveal is always quite exhilarating. It may not stay that way very long, but it's a nice moment, I will say that.
I was going to say, there's always that hint of, I don't know, kind of regret of having done this segment in the first place every time I do suggest a film. So thanks for bearing with me as we get a few films out of our system. So Batman and Robin was, yes, in fact, my suggestion, having been a film that I hadn't seen in its entirety up until now. So, you know, I'd obviously heard all the rumours and knew its sort of backstory a bit, so I was glad to be able to see the two-hour film in its entirety. So I'm glad to see you survive the other end of it, Trevor.
Yep, 2 hours. Yet again, I looked at the running time and just went, 2 hours, and took a deep breath and pressed play.
I know, but, you know, thankfully, look, there's been more excruciating experiences in terms of running time with a film, so it did go past quite fast, but yes, it was an adventure, yeah.
Sure, well, I suppose before we get too much into the movie itself, I guess we should start with a bit of turkey trivia. Still trying to think of a better name for this section, but it's still going to have to do for now.
I think with the film we're looking at tonight, I think it's quite an appropriate title. So I think we keep it.
Okay, excellent. So starting with a bit of turkey, Batman and Robin from 1997, as we said, is rated a grand total of 3.7 out of 10 on IMDb. And it was made with a budget of about $125 million. And then ended up grossing a bit over $238 million worldwide. So not quite. I know you've mentioned it before. The whole thing is not considered a success unless it makes back double its budget. So it didn't quite make it by the looks of things there, Christian.
Oh, well, yeah, just under. But, you know, for a film that's so infamous for its badness or whatever other people are dubbing it, you know, that is not a bad box office result. I would have expected quite a lower one. So maybe those numbers are more generated from the first weekend before sort of word of mouth got out about the film. So yeah, I was quite surprised, and they would have had such a big budget even for the marketing from what I've seen of it too, with the whole, you know, the franchise was worth so much at that time because they were still riding off the coattails of Batman Forever. And I did read that it actually was rushed to cash in on Batman Forever, so I don't know if that was a lot to do with any of the weaknesses that we're seeing in the film, where they were just kind of like, gosh, let's just get this out as quick as possible while people are still Batman crazy.
Yeah, definitely could explain a few things about it.
Well, you know, like, I've got even a note here where Warner Brothers even said to Joel Schumacher, now, you correct me if I'm wrong, Joel Schumacher was the producer of all four of the films, or was he only Batman Forever and then the next one? I think he was all of them, wasn't he?
Tim Burton was Batman.
Well, he directed. I just thought Joel Schumacher was the producer or the guy behind, but he must have taken the directorial reins for Batman Forever onwards, which is funny because you do look at those two films and see sort of how the campiness and the difference between, say, the Tim Burton product. But Warner Brothers even said to Joel Schumacher, can you make this film more toyetic? And I had to even look up the term toyetic, and that is a film term where essentially can you make a movie that we can make heaps of products from all the characters. You know, he apparently, you know, Warner Brothers oversaw a lot of the making of it, went, no, you know, that character isn't, that's not product enough, you know, you can't make that into a toy. So that sort of gives you a lot of the mindset that was going into this product. So you're essentially feeling that they were just like churning out the next film in this series and just seeing what would happen.
Yeah, indeed. So well, there we go. That was a very smooth transition into the trivia section there, Christian.
Yeah, I know. It wasn't intentional, but I was quite impressed with it.
Very, very well done, and probably a bit more tasteful than one of the ones I found, which was that due to the difficulty and large amount of time it took to remove the Batman suit, George Clooney apparently urinated in the suit on at least one occasion.
And that's probably the version of the suit we're seeing in some of the scenes, so gosh. But hey, it was quite a highly sought-after role in the 90s to play Batman, so I think George probably was willing to do anything. So, yeah. But, you know, you've got the whole, you've got the George Clooney, you know, as we mentioned, with being Batman and always sort of being, you know, the main character, but I was really quite surprised that Arnold Schwarzenegger is, in fact, the guy that takes top billing. So they really had a lot of faith in him as I suppose pulling, you know, taking the film to places that they were expecting and didn't quite make.
Yeah, I did notice that, and it got that quite prominently in my notes. So I think Arnold was a much bigger draw than George Clooney at the time. I think George was still very much a TV actor when this one came out. But you're saying it was a very sought after role. But apparently before George Clooney was cast, the first choice was to try to get Val Kilmer back, and he refused to return. And then they tried to get David Duchovny before finally getting George Clooney in the bat suit, to his relief.
Were they going through a phase of, okay, if we can't get them, we'll just go through a whole heap of TV actors, because I suppose David Duchovny would have been quite big with X-Files at the time. So it's really quite interesting. So maybe they saw it as a sinking ship, because, you know, admittedly, I'm quite a fan of Batman Forever. I haven't seen it for a while, but it's still kind of getting in that stage where maybe Val Kilmer, for example, was like, no, I'm backing out. This is getting a bit too camp, a bit too colourful for the Batman that I kind of want to be involved with. So, yeah, there would have been quite a lot of kind of, but you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger apparently was paid up to, I'm not 100% sure, it might have been $25 million or something ridiculous to play the role of Mr. Freeze, which, and essentially he probably got $1 million a word if you really broke it down.
$1 million a pun.
But yeah, oh gosh, I've got that here in my notes. Enough with the ice puns already. Oh, you literally got to the point where, yeah, you knew what he was going to say next.
Yeah, it was pretty obvious, but yeah, I think we can come back to that later. Now,
definitely.
For those who don't know, Batman and Robin, it's, well, basically the plot is Batman and Robin have to try to keep their relationship together. There's a bit of tension in the Batcave, even as they're trying to stop Mr. Freeze and Poison Ivy, played by Uma Thurman, from freezing Gotham City.
And that pretty much sums it up in a nutshell. A lot of action sequences and a lot of, yeah, I'm better than you, I'm better than you in the Batcave. So, yeah, you summed it up quite well there, actually, Trevor.
Yeah, I think with the previous ones, I mean, I suppose they did delve a bit further into the Batman character, but this, I think it's safe to say that this was definitely a surface-level movie. You don't need to look too much into this movie because you're not going to find any deeper hidden meanings underneath, I believe.
And especially when you've got, like, you just need to look at, like, say, Elle Macpherson, who plays, I suppose, the female love interest. You know, in all the previous films, the female love interest had been quite a major character. She's pretty much shunned to the side, you know, which I believe apparently a lot of scenes were cut. So, yeah, it is essentially, let's just make it as action-filled as we can and go for it. And pretty much, as I said, cashing in on the previous films. So, and as a result, it comes across quite rushed and, yeah, not much character development. Yeah, you don't come here looking for character development, especially if you're a big Batman fan. But anyway.
Yeah, well, before we delve into that, let's just start, I suppose, at the bottom of the barrel. And I've got a review here that I think can probably set our baseline, and we'll see how we go from there. we source these reviews from Amazon because there's just a glorious selection there. This one's titled, Thank Your Saints That Movies Can't Produce Odors. How to review one of the five worst movies ever made. I could say that Batman and Robin play less like a superhero movie and more like an episode of A Queer Eye for the Hero Guy, but that doesn't quite capture the true level of putrid that this film reaches. I could say that Alicia Silverstone playing Batgirl and spandex pants are not friends, but that might seem a little too snarky. I could say that Joel Schumacher's direction is so non-existent and Akiva Goldsman's writing so abysmal that the entire film never manages to reach the quality of the average high school talent show, but that doesn't give enough credit to talent shows. I could point out that all the flashing neon that assaults the viewers during nearly every scene and from nearly every bat device that the stealthy Dark Knight uses causes severe eye strain before the movie is halfway through. But most viewers lost their visions when their eyes were poked out by the huge hard nipples on the Batsuit, and the rest of the viewers either turned it off or committed suicide before the halfway mark anyway. I could say that Arnold Schwarzenegger, George Clooney, Chris O'Donnell, Uma Thurman, and Alicia Silverstone all turned in the worst performances of their entire careers, and with Silverstone that's really saying something, but that might be too obvious since none of them ever mentions this film at all, even when asked about it. But instead of saying all that, I think I can sum it up best like this. Not since Manos, The Hands of Fate, the worst film ever made, have I actually felt myself aging second by second while watching a movie until I watched Batman and Robin. I have no doubt that this movie plays on a continuous loop in hell. 1 star.
Oh, God. So I still managed to pick out some quite interesting points there, but, ooh, that was harsh.
Yeah, it was a bit of a long one, but I thought that it really did sum up the feelings of those 1-star reviews quite well.
And I have seen Menos, The Hands of Fate, and, yeah, to compare it to that, this reviewer definitely didn't like it. So some interesting things that they brought up and very valid points, actually, as well. So
Yeah, I mean... Getting into the movie itself, and you did mention it before in that very dramatic opening title credit sequence, and yeah, for the movie called Batman and Robin, the first name that comes up is Arnold Schwarzenegger before our two heroes. And I don't know, do you think that maybe did kind of set the tone that that they really wanted us to pretty, say, focus more on the major bad guy than the good guys?
Oh, look, I just think it would have been at the stage where they wanted to get as many, I suppose, as many big names or anything they can do to sell this film, and they would have got Arnold Schwarzenegger and done whatever they could have. But as a result, in the opening credits, making it glaringly obvious, you know, telling us exactly what was happening behind the scenes, which, yeah, I think was definitely a bad idea. But the big, the mentality, I think, with Joel Schumacher was he was definitely going, and it, even before I sort of looked this up, I was even thinking as I watched the film, it was very much going the angle of the Adam West 60s TV show. Now, I'm assuming you've seen, or you've seen bits of the 66 Batman film, you know, with the shark repellent, and it's really cheesy and the really over the top, and Joel Schumacher was sort of going back into that sort of, I suppose, dare I say, campy sort of angle for this film. He's even openly admitted that he wanted to capture that sort of film, hence the reason why there was this very bright neon and very colourful. But I think in many ways that went against it, because Batman had been set up as being so serious, especially in those first two films, that he really just came along with this and just went, blah, and tried to throw too much of that campness into it. I don't know, he's saying that apparently when he was filming the movie, pretty much before he went action on every take, he reminded the cast, remember you guys are in a cartoon, action. So that, if that can give you a bit of the mentality of what was going into this product, you know. And whilst, you know, it is, you know, there's nothing wrong with it being cartoony, I just don't think it fitted in a lot with the feel of the sort of the earlier ones, and he was just trying to just ramp up that campness. And yeah, as you said, the struggle, when you mentioned the whole troubles in the Batcave, you sort of had this, you know, I don't want to say it, but you do read a lot of reviews, this sort of homoerotic sort of thing going on between them. But it is this weird writing where they're trying to show that there's trouble at home, but we've only got Batman and Robin as the two people who are having trouble at home. So, yeah, it is a really, it doesn't quite know what it wants to be in that respect.
Yeah, I definitely felt that, like, after the initial gratuitous shots of the close-ups of the bat nipples and the bat butts during the opening sequence where they're getting ready, as they're thinking, yeah, okay, And they don't waste time. They go straight through. They crash in on Arnold Schwarzenegger as Mr. Freeze, and that whole fight between Batman, Robin, and the ice hockey henchman. I'm just waiting for the title cards to come up, going zap, kapow, wham. They would have fitted right into that scene, but then at the same time, they were still trying to go for that gothic feel of the previous movies, I felt, in a lot of the cases. And I think that was probably one of the first things that really started making this movie come unstuck for me, because to try to keep that gothic feel and that darker feel while at the same time trying to bring in aspects of the gloriously campy 60s TV show, it really does throw the entire thing off kilter.
Well, yeah, exactly. Like, you've got those, a lot of those sort of shots where they pan out and sort of show Gotham or sort of pan into a building, and they're kind of trying to, yeah, keep up with that sort of the Burton-esque gothicness. But then the next scene you'll have these, you know, these gaudy, almost sort of bright costumes and these neon lights. And one thing that I noticed, it almost felt claustrophobic in a way. It felt so obvious that they filmed this movie on one set, that they're just changing for every scene. That just, I don't know, that for some reason that stood out to me, and it just felt very, well, even though I'm sure that was how Batman and Batman Returns were filmed, but I never once felt that with those movies. So it really didn't capture that. It was too, yeah, almost too lollipop and too colourful and not trying to, yeah, not fitting in with that original gothic feel, which is what Gotham's all about.
Yeah, indeed. And it seems to be rushing through this rather fast, but with the bad guys, the bad guys in the Batman series of this time were all very larger-than-life characters, but they all really had, like, a sinister undertone, whereas I think any undertone for Mr. Freeze and Poison Ivy really gets undone by the fact that Mr. Freeze keeps cracking these terrible, terrible ice puns. And then there was a whole scene where he was trying to get all the henchmen to sing along with this theme song
from this cartoon. Oh, no.
Which was just painfully out of place. And Uma Thurman seemed to be trying to channel Mae West at her worst as Poison Ivy.
Oh, look, that's one of the biggest things that sort of affects me. Like, I'm a huge Uma Thurman fan, and, you know, I have spoken to other people, and they've really said, look, her entire career has been built around pretty much Pulp Fiction and Kill Bill when you really break it down. But I love her in those films. But I just felt she was obviously having an absolute ball making this, but she almost needed to rein her performance in so much more. She was almost the most campus part about it. She was trying to get too hard, and yeah, there was just something about it. And of course, once you've got her up against Mr. Freeze and his one-liners, or wouldn't even call them witty one-liners, you know, it just becomes a recipe for disasters, villain-wise anyway. So I don't know. I don't know if I'm being... I want to say that Uma tried her hardest, but just... Yeah, a lot of this film seems to be weighing on her and the way that she's performing it, and the way that the director almost didn't rein her performance in. But then, hey, if you're told before every take, this is a cartoon, I can easily see why she'd do that. So that's sort of what I was quite noticed about it.
Well, I think it's actually there that she still manages to be the best actor in the entire movie, because it doesn't take very long to realise that the way it's being played by everybody else. I honestly do think that this is the worst acting I've seen from even Arnold, and that's saying a lot, because I've seen Hercules in New York.
Oh, yes, exactly. I think that's been a previous redeeming feature, of course.
Yes.
But it's almost like they couldn't give him any more than those witty one-liners, because you can hardly understand what he says when he says three lines, let alone that, you know. But, like, you know, like, he even got to, like, halfway through when he'd come out with things like, hey, chill, and you're like, oh, God, that should have been the pun you got over and done with. You know, it was like just trying to push this thing up a hill, and it just wasn't working. It was a sinking ship, definitely.
Again, going with that whole... mismatch of feel. So you've got all this cartoon antics going on in this gothic city, and in the middle of it all, you've got Bruce Wayne's faithful butler Alfred ill with a fatal disease. So that's nice and cartoony and campy and upbeat, isn't it?
Oh, well, they had to have that extra side bit. Of course, some way to be able to bring Alicia Silverstone into it, of course, you know. But I have read things saying, like, I'm not up to date with that sort of stuff, but saying that apparently in the comics she was actually his daughter, not his granddaughter or something like that.
She was Commissioner Gordon's daughter.
Oh, that's it. Sorry, I thought it was another relationship to Alfred, but no, that's interesting. So that would have been another thing to annoy the fans of the comic books.
I think by the time Alicia Silverstone turned up, they were already well and truly annoyed.
Well, that's actually one thing I realised. I was halfway through. I was going, is she ever going to turn up? She just kind of appears, and yeah, it kind of felt like a very much an afterthought. But they were really trying to develop that whole sort of Batgirl and Robin thing, and it just wasn't working. It was, I think, a lot of it was to do with there was absolutely no chemistry between those two.
And then and even the dialogue between them, where I think at one point they sort of like got to try to hack into a computer, and Robin just goes, "Stand back, little girl," and he goes, "Oh, I'll show you how to do it, little boy." It's like, is that meant to be flirting, or are they just getting ready to have a adolescent punch up?
Yeah, or maybe they legitimately thought they were supposed to be these kid, like early teens. Actually, that's probably what they were supposed to be, is late teens anyway, but I wasn't convinced. But it was really quite interesting. But it was just trying too hard to be comical all the time. And as you said, with the Alfred bits too, trying to bring in that kind of, you know, Alfred's dying, you know, you've gone from, you know, juxtaposition from like this really campy action scene to, hey, yeah, Alfred's about to die. You know, it's quite a weird thing, you know, and it all comes back to, you mentioned his name earlier, but the script writer, it all comes down a lot to him, I'm thinking.
Well, again, I mean, if this was rushed out to, you know, cash in on the fact that Batman was still riding pretty high at the time, but then they decided that, you know, they really wanted to focus on the potential tie-in with regards to merchandising. I guess it really didn't really have that much to work with. I'm just trying to think because, seriously, I could talk about bad things in this movie. I'm just trying to think of some of the better scenes. And I think the only thing that worked was, for me, during the movie, was Poison Ivy's grand entrance and the big ball, and there was like this instrumental arrangement of the song Poison Ivy going in the background, and I was thinking, I love this version of the song. This is amazing, and it worked quite well with it at that point in time. It was just this brief moment of, okay, I'm on board with this, and unfortunately, that scene ended, and we were back to the other stuff.
But that was one of those great examples in that scene of showing that Uma was just having an absolute ball. She's just gone, let's stuff it. This is going to be as camp as anything. Let's just do it. And you can tell she was absolutely having a ball. But that kind of did remind me, as you were saying that too, a lot of the, you know, they were definitely going for a more of a family-friendly audience than, say, the earlier two films being being more sort of, you know, darker and things like that. I wouldn't be surprised. I'm assuming this movie's only rated PG. I don't know, but I did feel that it was definitely trying to be a lot more, family friendly. So I don't know. It's and that would probably be a lot to do with why it's not so dark as well. So, but of course, even, you know, there was, you know, there's no holding back even for Uma. I think there was even, I've got a reference here too. I think even Dr. Freeze goes, yeah, nice stems or nice buds or something like that. So even the witty one-liners come out, even involving Poison Ivy as well. So
nearly everything she said was a double entendre.
Yeah. I think pretty much anything anybody said, especially villain-wise in that film, and, you know, which actually brings me to another part, is apparently the character of Bane, he was sort of like pushed aside as almost this sort of sub-character. A lot of fans were quite annoyed because he was quite a big, you know, you were mentioning earlier, you know, a lot of these characters that have quite a sinister side that was never really developed, and they were quite distraught because they'd taken this quite iconic character from the comic books and pretty much just relegated him to Uma's henchmen, you know. So, but as you were saying, you know, by now people would have already gone, this is another comic book.
It makes me wonder if with the Chris Nolan Batman series and the fact that, you know, he brought Bane back as the main bad guy for the final of that trilogy, if maybe Chris Nolan was trying to rescue Bane from the atrocious treatment he gets at the hands of this movie.
Well, you know, but then I also was thinking about it as I was watching, and I'm like going, you know, not knowing, I don't really know much about the Christopher Nolan Batmans. I don't even think I've seen half of them, but I was going to say, I a lot of those characters, for example, like Poison Ivy, trying to show them in the sort of Christopher Nolan way would come across quite strange. It's almost like it's good they existed in the Joel Schumacher version because they could be as camp as anything and kind of get away with it. So I wondered if that was, you know, that was something, you know, how could you show these characters without them being camp, especially Mr. Freeze. But from what I've read, he's going to be a character even in the future Gotham series as well too. So they're obviously working out more legitimate and more serious ways of being able to portray him rather than just this one-liner that Arnie portrayed him as. So.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that if you use this as a baseline and what's happening now, it's a good indication of how far comic book movies has come, because instead of just saying, oh, we can't do what's in the comic book because no one reads it, we need to make it more accessible for people, is definitely now a case of where people are going, okay, no, we'll keep pretty close to the comic books because that's what people like.
Yeah, that's so dear. And, like, look at this. This has almost been in, you know, like 20 years' time, you know, like there has been a big change. And that's one thing when you're noticing, it just felt so 90s. It felt so of its period, Batman and Robin. So, you know, you can definitely see the change. But I was really, I actually thought it was really interesting seeing references to Arkham Asylum, actually, because I don't remember that being a big thing in the sort of the previous Batman movies, but it was good being able to sort of see reference to that because obviously Arkham Asylum's, you know, a lot more of a, you know, they make a big thing of it in more of the recent films. So that was cool to be able to sort of show that side of it as well. I thought that was pretty cool.
But the guards at Arkham Asylum were pretty much useless though.
Oh, no. That's to make it as easy as they could for them to escape or whatever.
I don't think they should have staffed Arkham Asylum with the Keystone Cops.
Yeah,
I mean they're getting attacked and they're just basically throwing themselves at Bane as he's coming through, and it's not until everyone jumps out of a hole in the wall that they actually pull their guns out. So good guarding there, guys.
That's probably Joel Schumacher's touch. Hey, we want Keystone Cops for the Arkham Asylum. It fits in with the cartoon feel. So. Well, one part that actually I've just remembered too, one part that kind of felt really weird or almost unnecessary was the Batman or George Clooney, or Bruce Wayne, sorry, flashbacks. You know, had these flashbacks to him as a child, you know, I suppose, you know, coming to terms with certain different things. But it would be something like he'd look into a window and that window would become the screen of the, I don't know, the flashbacks became a bit cheesy to me. I don't know, it was almost like that was another one of them trying to bring in that kind of serious angle to this really campy film.
Yeah, I think that really ties into the whole Alfred Bruce Wayne side of the story, because you have this moment where Alfred basically, yeah, they admit they love each other and Alfred really gets Batman, but like those flashbacks are all young Bruce Wayne doing something with Alfred, and I guess they're trying to build up that emotional connection between the two. Before they force the actor playing Alfred to lie in bed for the last half of the movie.
Yeah, but honestly, after being involved in that movie, I think it'd probably be, that's probably the best place to be. Because I think he was the only actor that had made it through, like, most of the season, actually, or most of the series, sorry. So, yeah, he would have been just rolling his head going, oh, gosh, I can't believe this is going to kill the franchise, and essentially did, so... But yeah, no, a couple of other things, you know, I love, you know, obviously spoiler alert, but the way of getting around Poison Ivy was the use of the fake lips. I'm like, oh, you're not. And there were so many different gadgets that come out with, you know, even the credit card and other things that you just gosh, this is as cartoony as anything.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to be seeing the Bat credit card in Batman vs. Superman, which it may not be a bad thing. But yeah, the wax lips, the whole wax lips thing, because Poison Ivy has poisonous kisses, I am absolutely positive that I did see that same thing used in an old episode of the 60s Batman TV series. I am 100% positive that there is that is something directly taken from...
I wouldn't be surprised. It sounds like Joel Schumacher was quite a big fan of the 60s one, so hey, I would not be surprised at all. So, but you know, interesting way of getting around it, but yeah, it just adds to one of those campy elements. Hey, I'm ripping my lips up. Oh, it was one of those things that just happened. I'm like, oh, of course.
Yeah, I mean, well, after, I think, what we had? We had skates inside the bat boots, which was very handy. Of course, the grappling hooks that have an apparently endless length of cable. and the wax lips. I mean, really, Batman's and Robin are prepared for anything, aren't they?
Oh, really? Yeah, of course, you know. And then, you know, just when they thought they've got it all solved, they've got Batgirl now joining the gang. But it was really interesting how Alfred had set it up that if she ever came down to the Batcave and discovered what had happened, he had this suit ready and waiting for her, which is funny because you think that he'd be all sort of anti her wanting to do that sort of stuff. But, yeah, I just thought that was funny how she had the suit ready to go. And the next thing, she's Batgirl. It just seemed kind of – it was trying to be this big reveal and trying to be this something exciting, but it just felt so underwhelming.
Yeah, I do think that they tried to be a bit clever with that. They had the whole setup that that Alfred wanted to get this information to his long-lost brother who travelled around India with a Raj on an elephant. But I think the intent was that he knew Barbara would try to access the material, and the whole intent was to have Barbara discover the Batcave and join in, but without actually being, you know, really over the top about it.
It was an interesting thing. Like, I'm not knowing much about the character, say, from the comic books, but I don't know if that was the way that was sort of originally done. But
nothing like it.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, this has all been thrown out the window up until this point. So, and that's just another thing. They just spent so much time getting into it too. Like, I suppose they do have that, you know, they did have that 2-hour running time. But yeah, the first hour is just setting up so much stuff, and then just to be just an assault of action scenes pretty much from then on. But, you know, that said, for a 2-hour movie, it still didn't feel like it. Let's just say that.
Okay, well, I'm glad it didn't feel like a 2-hour movie for you, Christian.
It sounds like it may have for you.
I'll get to that later. But one thing I did notice, just getting back to Batgirl for a second, when she finally did get the suit that was ready for her, we had the same close-up of the bat nipples and the bat butt when she was getting ready, but I noticed that the bat nipples were not quite as anatomically correctly designed on her suit as it was for Batman and Robin.
It was almost like, I don't know, they were worried. But we better tone this down, we might get complaints or something like that. It's all right for the other two to have it. But yeah, no, I noticed that too.
And I don't really think, like, her joining in actually adds all that much to it. She doesn't actually do all that much. I think about the only thing I can say for her is that I found most of the fight scenes pretty underwhelming. They were mainly just grappling and not that much action. But the actual fight between Batgirl and Poison Ivy, I think I would actually put that as the best of a bad bunch with regards to this movie. Because Poison Ivy very quickly restrains both Batman and Robin, and then in comes Batgirl to save the day in an actual decent fight.
She kind of redeemed herself, or redeemed the character, essentially. So, I noticed that too about it, because, yeah, up until that point, yeah, her use in the film was kind of not much, but it was almost like they had to have that there as that sort of love interest for Robin, even though it kind of wasn't delivered or delved in too much. And as we said, there was virtually no chemistry whatsoever. But, you know, hey, there was barely any female lead, so maybe our two lead couple was essentially Batman and Robin.
Quite possibly. But I do like at the end of that scene, though, how they just walked off and just left Poison Ivy there with like, nobody guarding her.
I know. Oh, that's just one of those. By then, they would have just been, even the crew would have been throwing their hands like, oh, we've had enough. Yeah. Oh, gosh. But yeah, no, it just seemed like, it seemed a lot of time, too, that Uma Thurman was just trying to outdo Arnold Schwarzenegger, almost trying to keep up with him as well, because they were both sort of that equally sort of camp and out there. So, it definitely was entertaining in that respect.
Oh, but every time I thought the dialogue couldn't get worse, I got proved wrong quite quickly. And I think that coincided with the increase of the dialogue between Poison Ivy and Mr. Freeze. As they talked more, the general dialogue just kept getting worse and worse.
Oh, I know. You just think, imagine what it would have been like on set. Like, are they going, I can't believe we're saying these words? Or, but they, as I said earlier, it does look like they're having a ball. But I suppose Arnie would have just been thinking about the money.
Yeah, but it's safe to say that Arnie was in there for the payday, perhaps.
Yes, I think so. And hey, he definitely got a payday with that. So. Mm-hmm.
Actually, another, I think probably the other standout actress, I guess, in this movie, I've just got to bring this in mention when Alicia Silverstone is trying to guess the password to the disc that Alfred has given to her for her safekeeping. And, as she's just basically randomly picking words, which is it shows that she's such a great hacker. And it just gets a very, very basic computer voice of, you know, access denied, access denied. And then when she finally gets it right, it sounds like the computer's is way too delighted with the fact that the correct password's been typed in.
It's like, yeah, we knew you'd do this in only two or three goes, but yeah, it was almost a bit too easy that she managed to crack it.
Yeah, but yeah, it was just like, password accepted.
Yeah. Oh, yes. As soon as you said it like that, I'm like, yes, I remember now. I remember thinking, oh my gosh. Oh, yeah.
And then, you could talk a lot about Batgirl with regards to the ridiculous things. So you also mentioned that, Alfred was ready for her to find the Batcave, and when she gets down there and Alfred crossed with Max Headroom appears on the screen to basically say, welcome to the Batcave, and tell her that her suit is ready. I'm thinking, were they deliberately trying to cross Alfred with Max Headroom in that scene, or was it just a coincidence, do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. It was, that part of it, the whole, it just seemed to, and it all happened so quickly where it was almost sort of, it wasn't too much of a reveal. I don't know, it was very underwhelming. It was almost like, ah, she's joining the gang.
Yeah, everyone knew it was coming.
Yeah, I know. Well, that's the thing. I got to a point where I'm like going, is Alicia Silverstone even going to appear? Because she wasn't in it, you know, for the first sort of maybe 45 minutes, maybe a bit earlier. But, and I was kind of wondering, you know, when they were going to bring her in. But I think as soon as the tension between Batman and Robin died down, they could bring in the female love interest.
Indeed. Well, yeah, because she just kind of, she turns up, sneaks off with the bike, and then a large chunk of the movie goes by before she comes back with the bike. And then that's when you have Robin follow her the second time she sneaks out with the bike, and she find out, oh my goodness, she's an underground street racer.
Whoa!
Really?
So maybe it's been good we haven't had to follow her for half the movie.
But the whole street race scene, aside from obviously putting her in peril, and the only reason she's in peril is because the other guy cheats, just so she can be saved by Robin. Like, that whole underground racing scene really has nothing to do with the rest of the movie.
Oh, I know. It's almost like, it's not like you need to get a longer running time or anything. So, yeah, it was almost like they were giving her something a little bit more impressive, say, to do. So, yeah, I thought that as well.
I guess I had to show that she was tough and independent before she was put in peril and turned into a damsel in distress.
Yeah, even though we already know that Alfred was more than happy to give her the suit for it to go and do. So, yeah, so he obviously had faith in her.
If only we could have faith in his acting performance as he really laid on the sickness.
Oh, I know, and it's like, especially when you've, as we said earlier, when you've got these big scenes of camp, it's really hard to kind of rein in that whole, oh, we've got a dramatic scene now, and kind of actually feel some sort of drama from it. So, yeah, that they just felt so out of place.
Oh, God.
An interesting film.
Indeed, I've got to mention this as well. Because we mentioned it, again, this is something we have talked about in a previous Redeeming Features, and because this use of this telescope to freeze Gotham, and when they finally take it down, this big chunk of metal and glass hits the ground and explodes!
I know.
There just has to be an explosion, doesn't there? Even if there's no sense in something exploding, that's just...
Oh, you know, and I think with this one, if you've got a budget of $125 million, they've got to have as many explosions as they can, you know. Like whenever, like, I noticed every second scene had to have... You always have to have mist in the background in some way, shape or form. So, yeah, the explosions were... Yeah, that's what I was... Yeah.
It seemed pretty light on in explosions, actually. There's only really a few times they hats off explode.
But it was more the action scene after action scene, and there was that part where they were sliding down. I can't even remember in the final scene where they're sliding down that thing that was I can't even remember what it was, but and it just felt so fake, and just going back to that whole sort of that 60s Batman thing, and almost, you know, even though sort of CGI wouldn't have necessarily been employed too much or even at all with it, you know, it just felt, a lot of it just felt like that, and it just felt so studio bound.
Well, the CGI that was used was blatantly obvious and stuck out like a sore thumb.
Yeah, so you'd know it if you saw it. Yeah, so there's always, and there's like, I noticed a lot of things like characters, like for the first, you know, how I said it took quite a while to build up. I remember also in, you know, the first sort of, the first few scenes with Poison Ivy, it's like the characters kept trying to fill us in what was happening rather than it sort of coming through like a natural narrative. It was just sort of like, okay, well, we did this and then we did that. Like, almost like they're just trying to develop as much of the characters as they can as possible. I noticed that a lot with the whole development of Poison Ivy and sort of how she became what she did. It was just very, okay, cool. You're talking us through, yeah, the motions. And they were almost trying to replicate the Catwoman scene in Batman Returns. Not replicate it, but try to give her something that was equally as, you know, maybe shocking, but, you know, quite failed miserably. Yeah. You know, this character being, I suppose, like tipped down into this well or whatever it was, and all these poisons and venoms falling all over her. So, you know, it could have been handled, it could have been done so much better, but it wasn't.
No, we needed all that exposition and that extraneous character who was only there to set up Bane and Poison Ivy.
And I know, and he relished in his whole mad scientist. I think that was pretty much probably his job description. Play this as mad scientist as you can, because that's pretty much how we did it. So, yeah, I felt those scenes very awkward and very almost, I suppose, tacky is the word. But hey, tacky could be a word to be used for most of the film, so.
Mm-hmm. Quite possibly. Right through to, again, could be, we'll have to watch this right through to the very, very, very end. You've got that, U2 tune. That's a bit hard to say.
That's right, because that was the big song for the film, yeah.
Big song for the film that comes in over those closing credits, which is bearable, I guess. But then, as you watch it, it cuts to this very soft song, all about Gotham City, and I've got to think that that's probably one of the worst songs I think I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah, I watched it, but I even probably zoned out as it being some, just like some soundtrack song. But yeah, no, it obviously affected you in more than it did for me.
Oh, it kind of, yeah, the lyrics kind of filtered in, and
Look, it all comes back to think there's even a soundtrack for this film kind of baffles me a bit. So, but hey, you know, it was big money at the time, and it did make big business. But, and like, hey, look, I remember following the Batman series up until sort of, I suppose, Batman Forever, but I do always remember this coming out and being just this absolute dud. But I never saw it, never sort of looked into it a bit more. But yeah, it was definitely a big time for Batman films. So it was just a natural progression, but probably not the best progression, especially with Joel Schumacher at the helm and making it as camp as anything.
Very, very true. So now, again, we've gone to the closing credits, so I guess that's a good point to move on and talk a bit, talk about if there is actually anything redeemable about this. So you pick this, Christian, so I shall go first, if you don't mind.
No worries. Gives me time to actually think about some redeeming features. I do have a couple, but yeah, it is a hard one. I am dying to know what you think.
Okay, well, you may, I'll just dive into it. So, obviously the first thing is the fact that as a 2-hour movie, this movie is way too long, and it's got all the expositional dialogue in there in the place of actually telling the story through action, which would have brought it down a bit. But seriously, it's got a terrible plot, terrible dialogue, terrible acting in amongst all this. The fight scenes were either completely campy, cheesy 60s Batman fare or just plain poorly choreographed. They really were trying hard to blend the modern-day movie sensibility with the cheesy campiness of that 60s TV show, and really they failed spectacularly. The one-liners, the awful, awful, awful one-liners just kept getting worse. I think the thing that you can take from this movie is, after seeing it, you can understand why the movie franchise was halted after this piece of trash was made. I now really completely and totally remember why I haven't bothered watching this movie since I watched it once when it first came out. This movie is trash. This movie is terrible. This movie has no redeeming features whatsoever. This movie is not redeemable, and I will happily never watch it again.
Oh my God, that is with a passion, Trevor. My God, the final word. Oh my gosh! So, well, we've definitely got a film that has that has made you quite certain on your answer for that. But look, oh gosh, okay. Well, you know, I did agree with a lot of the things you said, but in many ways too, I found that its campness was in many ways was what kind of gave it this kind of appealingness about it. Like, if you're wanting to see something kind of trashy, or you want to, dare I say, like, I hate mentioning this whole so bad it's good, this is probably one of the most ultimate movies you can see to kind of get that experience. But, you know, that aside, that's not redeeming it, but it is a mindless film. You know, you've got action scene after action scene, and you don't really have to think too much with it. You don't really want to have when I see you, for example, I haven't seen the Batman films, but when I hear reference to them or see trailers, I always think it's too much to think about. There's a lot of stuff from the comics that I might not know, or you're taking on board a lot. This is a lot more of that sort of mindless entertainment. I'm not saying this is a good film. I enjoy it for its campness and the fact that he was, you know, now knowing that he was trying to capture that whole 60s Batman feel, I can definitely see it. I can second what you say, Trevor. I can see why this did kill the franchise, but hey, to be honest, I would happily sit and watch this rather than watching one of the Christopher Nolan films. This to me is sort of in the realm of the 90s Batman that I was, you know, quite familiar with, you know, growing up, and sort of what I saw Batman as, and still fitting in with that 60s feel. I see it for all its badness as well, but I still see it. It's redeemable for it is redeemable for its badness. It's redeemable for the fact that you can watch it as a campy experience and kind of go, yeah, you know, have a bit of fun, very tongue-in-cheek. But, yeah, so, Trevor, it's a bit of a mixed bag there. So I don't think I even really know what I want to say, whether I think I am actually liking it for being so bad. I think that is the end result.
Okay, so you're coming in with the so bad is good. I've come in with so bad is bad.
We have. I knew the agreement on our film would not last for long, so we had to have some kind of dispute. So, but I'm glad that I made you endure that 2 hours of. Well, you do realise, Trevor, you've now watched 4 hours of Batman and Robin. I don't know how that feels in hindsight.
It's 4 hours. I would very much like to get back at some point. Maybe I can send Joel Schumacher a bill for my time.
Well, I have actually read that apparently people, fans, have actually told George Clooney in person, you know, how much they hate the film, and he actually give them a refund. So I don't know how you put a monetary value on that time of your life. I think it would have to be more than just the price of a movie ticket. So
sure. I'm just glad I didn't have to pay anything for this one because it was on Netflix. So if you do want to go see it, you can check it on Netflix if you're game.
Yeah, I don't necessarily know if we've sold you on it. So maybe you've got a few friends over and want to laugh at a film. You know, you can go to so bad it's a good angle. But Trevor's kind of also very convincing on his version of the film as well. So you can make that decision yourself. I'd love to hear anyone that decided to tackle it or has tackled it in the past.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? I've got someone here who did tackle it in the past and quite enjoyed it.
Okay.
So, I've got another review from Amazon here, and the title of this review is Why Snow Serious? You'll enjoy this.
That says enough about the review, Trev. Anyway, continue.
I don't understand the frigid reception this movie has gotten. I think people really need to chill out and enjoy it for what it is. Too many flaky reviewers are giving this movie the cold shoulder, if you catch my drift. The cast members definitely give the coolest performances of their careers, especially polar opposites Batman and Mr. Freeze. While George Clooney gives a biting performance, it's Schwarzenegger who really puts the icing on the cake, outwitting Batman at almost every turn. Only at the end, through his icy resolve, does Batman finally defeat his adversary. I mean, let's get real. Mr. Freeze was really skating on thin ice throughout. I would have posted this review sooner, but my computer froze on me a few times mid-sentence. 5 stars!
Oh, my God, the fact that he had to use those puns, he's as bad as the film itself. that is the worst. We almost need to try and redeem that review, but it would be irredeemable. So
that review is as bad as the movie itself.
Yeah, that sums it up perfectly. Oh gosh, yeah, that guy can live in his frozen world with Batman and Robin on repeat, and yeah, that he can stay doing that.
Yeah,
but yeah, I don't. You know, even though as I said, it's probably enjoyable as a bit of a camp or a bit of a, you know, like, you know, I'm having a bit of a laugh at a movie. I don't necessarily think I'm going to rush to watch it anytime soon myself.
Fair enough. Even though you do put it on the so bad as good scale.
Yeah, exactly. But so bad, it's like, yeah, I'd even consider, hey, would I do this as a midnight or a late night screening type thing? And I'm like going, no, I think people would just go, I'm not paying money for that bad movie. So yeah, I think that sort of gives a bit of an indication of what people think of it.
Yeah, I mean, I did actually put the feelers out for this one and did get a bit of a mixed response. I mean, we do have people out there who are fans of the badly punning Mr. Freeze and the performances of Uma Thurman as Poison Ivy. Really, I think if I can use one other person to sum this up, I will put a beep in this one, by the way, but I'll just quote this straightforward. He said, "What the movie, seriously?"
Oh, God. Yeah, I could see that being the response of a lot of people, probably half of the population when the film came out. So, yeah, actually, that sums it up in a nutshell. Especially the experience from what I've heard of a lot of people have had of the film. So, interesting, but it still seems to be one that kind of, it's good to know it's got some fans out there, but it's, yeah, it's probably more infamous for its badness.
Absolutely. So, there we go. Another divided opinion. We've had a few of these this year, haven't we?
Oh, definitely. Well, I'm as always interested to know what catastrophes we could possibly have next, because just when I think we've got the bottom of the barrel, you know, we'll come out with a bombshell.
Well, like, we guess we may find out. Now, before I go into this next one, I just want to mention that what you're listening to right now is the second last redeeming features cast for the year. We will be having a break after the next couple of podcasts go out. We'll be back for Christmas, but after that, we're really not going to do another proper podcast till next year. So essentially, what I'm about to mention is going to be the finale, the official finale of our first season of Standalone Redeeming Features podcasts. So I thought I would delve into the back catalogue of a performer who is very well known and very well loved. An Oscar winner who has appeared in everything from serious drama to wacky comedy to a very, very much loved kids franchise where he plays Woody in Toy Story. So who do you think I'm referring to here, Christian?
Ooh, are we talking about a certain Tim Allen from...
Oh, the wrong one. No, we're talking about Tom Hanks.
Oh, sorry, it was one or the other. Yeah, I knew it was one or the other. Damn it. I was hoping it was the one I picked.
Tom Hanks.
I was thinking of Tom Hanks doing a bad film in hindsight, so I'd be interested to know.
Well, before he had his big breakthrough, he did appear in a couple of smaller titles. Now, this is a bit more of an obscure title, but I think the fact that it stars Tom Hanks and it kind of came out in that very confused period. The Moral Crusaders had pretty much given up on blaming rock and roll music and the like for poisoning the minds of youth, and it was too early for computer games. So, in that confusing middle period, someone noticed that a role-playing game called Dungeons & Dragons was on the rise, and a book purportedly based on a true story was released, of which an adaptation was made movie-wise, and that's what we're going to watch, Christian. We're going to go back to 1982 and watch the Tom Hanks cautionary feature about Dungeons & Dragons, mazes, and monsters.
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited, Trevor, because you know what? I've never heard of this film in my entire life, and I'm so excited that you've suggested this. Wow. I don't know if I should be excited. I haven't seen this movie yet. I may eat my hat. Well, Trevor, well, you've kind of sold me on it. Not necessarily on the Dungeons and Dragons type thing, but the fact that this is this is extremely early Tom Hanks. Gosh, 1982. So, God, yeah, I'm really interested, and I love hearing about films that I wasn't aware of before. So, well, I'm up for the challenge.
Well, it's actually rated 4.2 on IMDb, so technically it's better than Batman and Robin.
Technically, a lot of things could be, but I'm really willing to delve into that to those mazes. So yeah, let's give it a go. I'm looking forward to it. I'm really excited to look at a movie we hadn't done before, or hadn't heard of before.
Excellent. So if anybody out there has seen Mazes and Monsters, or if you want to comment on Batman and Robin, if you think we've been too harsh or too generous, I guess it depends what side of the coin you fall on with our final opinion on that movie, then definitely get in touch with us. We're super easy to get in touch with. You can find The Rufus Project on Twitter and on Facebook quite easily. We have an email, therufusproject@gmail.com, or you can even head to our homepage, therufusproject.podomatic.com, and leave comments below this very episode.
Well, yeah, well, I'm looking forward to giving Mazes and Monsters a go, and hearing if anybody has any feedback on Batman and Robin, or as a suggestion for a future upcoming Redeeming Features. We're always keen on that too.
Yeah, well, the next season of Redeeming Features is now wide open, so if you want to get suggestions in for that, now would be an ideal time. Maybe we can run a few listener-suggested Redeeming Feature podcasts with our next season next year.
Could be. There's plenty of corkers out there that we've yet to even try. And I think after some of the stuff we've watched, I think we're up for the challenge.
Absolutely. Well, Christian, as always, it has been an absolute pleasure. It's definitely more fun recording this podcast in this particular case than watching the movie it was about.
Definitely, and hey, a shorter running time too. But yeah, no, I always look forward to what we're going to do next and what we look at. So yeah, look forward to the next one, Trevor. Thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot, Christian.
Good to be bad, so bad it's good. What's this movie? Do you think we should? Got bad dialogue, dodgy creatures, but we want to know what the redeeming features.
Boy? Oh boy.
Christian and Trevor on the case, watching movies from all over the place. IMDb says it's bad, but we want to know, is it fun to be had?
Boy? Oh boy.
Redeeming features.
Next door to happiness lives sorrow, and signals of solution in the sky. A city of justice, a city of love, a city of peace for every one of us. We all need it, can't live without it. A Gotham City.